I'm going to step away from the mic again for, I guess, about half an hour to 45 minutes so that Rabbi Saul Solomon can take the mic once more and talk to a person that he finds absolutely interesting and fascinating. It is another rabbi, an ordained rabbi from, I think it's Hebrew Union College. Let me get the sheet on him. I think the rabbi has it too. But he's an author of many books and really a very, very special lecturer and thinker on religion, all religions, in a new and very open way. He's a great guy. He's Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and he is coming into the neighborhood with Rabbi Saul Solomon. The rabbis are going to go at it. Dueling rabbis, ladies and gentlemen, on Dave's Gone By. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it starts right now.
Hi. Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By.
Shalom, damn it! This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, and I am so thrilled to be here on the Dave's Gone By radio program talking to another man of the cloth, another rabbi, which is really exciting. I think this is the first rabbi that I have spoken to on this program, or even in my life, because I am a very insular person. But the man that I am about to talk to, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, is the opposite of insular. He is reaching out to all different people, not only in the Jewish religion, but in all different religions in his quest to bring spirituality to humanity. I'm a mean, rotten son of a bitch, but him, this excites me. I want to see how another Jew does what I do, but in a much, much better way. Rabbi Rami was ordained at the Hebrew Union College. He has a doctorate in religious studies from Union Graduate School, which is kind of a non-traditional place, it seems. We'll ask him about that. And he is the founder of Temple Beth Or in Miami. And he's an adjunct teacher in Middle State, Tennessee. He's so busy, I don't know even how he has time to write all the books that he wrote. Let us just welcome and get right into the mind and the feelings of Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Shalom, Rabbi. Thank you so much for coming.
Shalom, Rabbi Saul. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and it's a pleasure. It's an excitement for me. Now, let's just jump right in. Let me say that you seem to be a champion of iconoclasm. I can't even believe I know that word. For example, in your weekly blog, you have written, "Here is my fantasy for a great Judaism that produces great Jews. Let's build a postmodern kind of belief where Jews are first and foremost taught how to think Jewishly rather than to live halachically, which is according to Jewish law." In other words, you want people to have the Jewish feeling and spirit rather than obeying the letter of the Talmud and the Torah. Am I sort of right on that?
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in. I have nothing against the halacha, but observing the law doesn't necessarily give you the Yiddish cup that I'm looking for.
Well, what does?
Well, I think the way that Jews classically study text, not the way you might get it in a Sunday school or in some of the more liberal ends of Judaism where we really are teaching for knowledge, kids, students should know X, Y, or Z. But there was a method of teaching that's thousands of years old in Judaism that is all about deconstructing the text, taking it apart, making it say things that the authors never imagined. So, for example, there's that story about Moses, where God lets Moses look into the future, and he sees the rabbis studying Torah, and there's Rabbi Akiva doing a drash, interpreting the crowns on the letters, and Moses just doesn't understand what he's talking about. And then when Akiva says, "And all this was taught to us by, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our rabbi," he says, "Oh, okay, I'm fine with that then." So I think that story is the rabbi's way of admitting what they're doing, which is creating new Torah out of old Torah and not feeling bound by the old, using it as a place to jump off from with their imaginations. And there's a way of doing that that allows Jews, that trains you to think paradoxically, to think iconoclastically, to break with the old, to allow the new to emerge. And that's what really excites me about the Jewish mind.
Were you trained in the old style and then you broke free from it, or was your training kind of iconoclastic and different and free from the beginning?
Well, my youngest training is in the Orthodox world, but go long enough in that world to get the kind of Talmudic training I'm talking about. And when I was in rabbinical school, it was, you know, it was the Reform Seminary, and the approach is very different. So, no, I wasn't trained that way. But what I've tried to do is to go back and study with people who were, and to learn how to do that.
So, who were some of the people that you studied with?
Well, my primary teacher is Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi. So, that's where I would put all my credit. But I studied with Mordechai Kaplan, Lava Shalom, when, you know, a long time ago when he was, I met him on his 99th birthday party.
You that's when you first met him? It was 99?
Yeah, he was 99. And physically, he was toward the end. I think he wanted to live to 103, 104. But
he didn't make it to 120, so the prayers did not work.
Close. But mentally, he was sharp. And I would meet with him once a week on Wednesday nights. I was living in Jerusalem, and he lived in Jerusalem, and I would walk to his house, and he was gracious enough to take me in and beat me up mentally.
Well, and then you would go ice skating together. So you show him.
Right.
Well, yes. But let's say the thing that worries me about what you, I wouldn't say preach, and that may not be the right word, but your belief system and the way you espouse it, which I guess is preaching, is the fact that you seem ecumenical and multi-religious in a way, that you kind of, not so much, of course you embrace Judaism, but you embrace all religions. Is that dangerous?
Well, it could be really silly. It depends how you do it. You know, I mean, the way I look at it is that religions are like languages. And, you know, there are things you can say in Yiddish that you can't say in French, and things you can say in
like schmuck. Schmuck, will, you know, there's no word for schmuck in Yiddish, but yes, continue.
So the more languages we know, the richer our capacity, the richer our experience and our capacity to articulate it. So, yeah, I think the more religions you know, the more, the broader your spirituality becomes, and the more articulate you become in understanding, experiencing, and communicating your spiritual life.
But there is a difference.
That's not the same as saying I'm Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist. You can't hyphenate them all in a sense and say, oh, they're all the same. No, the whole point is they're all different. English is not Chinese. And knowing the two of them is the whole point, is to broaden your mind. But to say, no, English and Chinese are equal, no, they're both languages, but they're each unique, and they have their own unique mindset.
That's okay, because I was worried that you were in that hyphenate zone, that they would pick and choose the smorgasbord from all different religions, which intellectually you can do. Of course, there's wonderful things in the New Testament, and I'm sure there's marvelous things in the Quran, you know, maybe a word or two.
Sure.
No, I'm kidding. But no, you're not the hyphenate. You are very definitely Jewish. You're just saying it's good to know about all the religions, and if there's good things in them, well, it's fine to share and to know where other people are coming from. Am I closer on that?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'm trying to think if I've ever used the hyphenate thing. I probably have. But what I have in mind is what you're saying, that my mother tongue is Jewish.
Of course.
So that's my grounding. But I do know these other languages, and I teach them at the university, and I find Buddhism to be an incredibly rich tradition from which I've learned a lot. And just to stick with Buddhism just as an example, I mean,
sure.
Buddhism has sensitized me to aspects of Judaism that I wouldn't have been open to before.
Well, Buddhism, I would imagine, or I've been told, I have not studied it properly. I can't meditate. I can't keep my mind on anything for more than a second and a half. But as a matter of fact, I've forgotten what I was going to ask. No, I'm kidding. But Buddhism doesn't directly contradict Judaism, as opposed to, say, Christianity or the Muslim stuff. I think Buddhism isn't necessarily religious belief. It's just a path Or am I confusing that with Zen and motorcycle maintenance?
Well, I think, you know, it always depends on what aspect of a religion we're talking about. I mean, certainly folk Buddhism, it might definitely contradict, you know, Judaism. But even philosophically, I mean, we say that, you know, this idea that you can be Jewish and Buddhist, and there's a whole, what they call Jew-Boo or Boo-Jew movement. And what those people, I think, have in mind, because I know many of them, but certainly not all of them, but I think what they have in mind, or what I've heard them say, is that the Buddhism they adopt isn't cultural. They may study Tibetan Buddhism, but they don't dress like a Tibetan, they don't eat like a Tibetan, they don't pretend to be Tibetan. So they can maintain their Jewish cultural identity and bring in the philosophical and spiritual teachings from Buddhism. But I would challenge that. I think that they do a disservice to both traditions when you say that Buddhism and Judaism do operate on two different planes. I mean, Judaism has the notion of the creator God, and Buddhism does not. And that's a fundamental difference. And when you actually, my experience, sitting with Buddhist practitioners, not Jewish Buddhist ones, but, you know, Tibetans and people from Southeast Asia and professors of Buddhism, and you start talking and try to find a way to work the God language of Judaism and make it compatible with Buddhism, they are not happy with that. So I think that yes, what we've done with Buddhism is that we've stripped it of everything. You know, the people who really brought the Jew-Boo thing together were Jews first.
Of course.
And they stripped...
I hate to tell you, but the people who brought Christianity...
Kind of upset Bubby and Zig, you know?
Yeah.
They've created a Buddhism for themselves that they could take home on Passover, and nobody would get upset. And that's... I understand it. Sociologically, I can understand it. But philosophically, I think it's problematic.
Well, it's the same thing with the Messianic Jews. God, God forgive them. The Jews for Jesus think that they can still be Jews while believing in Jesus. And it's like, no, it's the ultimate contradiction. You know? Absolutely impossible. Not. Sorry.
Well, of course, all the first Christians were Jews, so
right.
It used to be possible.
Well.
But today it's more of a... I mean, but then you'd have to say the same thing about Schneerson followers. Right? I mean, if you believe that Schneerson is the Mashiach, then is that Jewish anymore? So, you know...
No, it's not.
It's a little more dicey than you're making it sound. But I understand what you're saying. Mainstream Judaism does not posit a Messiah that has come. Christianity does. Certain branch of Chabad Hasidism does. But mainstream Judaism does not.
But actually, how big... I thought that was just a tiny little cult that died out, the Schneerson Chassids. Is that growing? Are they...
I thought that, too, until about 4 days ago. And I was in this discussion with people who know, and they said, and I was shocked, so, you know, maybe they're wrong, but they're in the world. And they said, no, that this is Chabad now, that they don't always talk about it, but it has become the norm of Lubavitch thinking. Now, I don't know if that's true. I mean, I just know from the small group of Hasidim I was talking to.
But wait, if they believe this, then why hasn't he risen? What do they wait? I mean, they think he's going to rise at some point? They think he's not really dead? What do they believe?
Well, they believe what Christians believe. I mean, they believe that he's coming back. You know, what do you do when your Messiah dies? I mean, you only have a few choices. You can, like when Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam, you can either convert to Islam with him, like the Dunmed did, or you can reject him and go a different direction. So you have to do something with a Messiah that has disappointed you, in a sense. So when Jesus dies, there's nothing in Judaism to say, our Messiah is coming, he dies and he comes back. But if you believe in him and then he dies, you have to salvage your belief, or you leave. You either say, oh, I was wrong.
No, but
if you can't say you were wrong, then you have to imagine something so you think he's going to come back. With Schneerson, it's the same thing. They thought, you know, he had a stroke. They thought the stroke would be miraculously healed, and that was going to prove who he was. Then he passed away. Then they thought he was coming back. I think it was his birthday, then his yahrzeit. So who knows? But
that's stupidity.
Let him go. You have to come up with some theory.
What I was going to say is just that at least the Goyim, they have a 2,000-year-old myth of all these things that Jesus already did come, he rose from the dead, pushed away the rock. Then, I don't know, he's been living in Las Vegas or something. But with Schneerson, they saw he had a stroke, he was in the hospital, they put him in the ground, they buried him, and he died. There's no myth, there's nothing to cling to, he's a dead old Jew.
Well, they must find something. I mean, because they do think he's coming back. So how they do that for themselves, that, you know,
only Barbara Streisand, perhaps, could really do that. You know, when she goes, she will come back and revive the Jewish race, I believe.
Oh, there now, you go.
Can I ask, if you are mainly as... See, you obviously do believe in a monotheistic God, and Judaism is at your core. Because I was going to ask, why religion at all, and not just secular humanism?
Well, I mean, you can do secular humanism. I can't shake the God thing, you know? And I'm a monotheist in the sense that I think not only is there only one God, I think God is... There's only one reality, and that is God. I'm not a dualist. I'm a non-dualist. You know, a dualist says there's a God, but it's separate from the universe. And I think the universe is part of God. So I'm a non-dual monotheist, if you like. But there's nothing wrong with secular humanism. I am very much there's much of what's called secular humanism that I absolutely agree with. But I have this thing about God. I mean, I have my experiences of what I would call the divine and my spiritual practices.
Well, forgive me for interrupting, but what experiences have you had where you really felt connected to the divine? I mean, I like vanilla ice cream, but that's as close as I get.
Well, but that's pretty close.
All right,
well, if you can, you know, taste and see that God is good, right? So if you can taste the vanilla ice cream and get true, you know, joy from that, it's not so different. My experience of God in meditation, in chanting, and different practices, both from the Jewish tradition and other traditions, I sense two things. First, an absolute interconnectedness with all life, and from that I feel this compassion from and compassion for everything. I mean, you know, this last 10 seconds, but I feel this infinite love, you know, ahava rabba, from and for everything. And then if I'm lucky and it happens, I slip from that sense of bliss to well, you can't say, because the self is gone, so there's no observer there at that point where I'm looking at it and say, oh, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that. But when I come back, the way I reconstruct the experience is that I melted into the divine, that I realized my oneness of God, and I'm a part of that. Because the way a wave returns to the ocean, that's the deepest meditative experience. So the word experience is in quotes there, because there's no one there to experience it. But I've tasted that to some extent, and then I've been in that place where the wave knows that all waves are part of the ocean, and we're all connected to that and to one another through that, and that experience as this ahava rabba, this endless love. So I've had those experiences, and I can't deny them, and that sort of takes me out of the pure secular humanist mode.
That's a very, very beautiful thought. You know, I'm thinking in terms of like walking in a field with dandelions, or all the cliches of that sort of walking on the rocky beach with the waves going, and just sort of feeling part of that, and as you said, not quite apart from that. Although I'm always sort of standing apart from everything. That could just be my hygiene problem. But let me ask Rabbi Rami Shapiro some other questions that have to do with his thoughts and his teachings. And by the way, before I ask more questions, I should direct people to your website, your blog, which is rabbirami.blogspot.com. It's rabbirami.blogspot.com. Plus, you've got a bunch of books that you have written. Where can people get those? Are they at the blog?
No, I don't sell anything. You can get them on Amazon, certainly, barnesandnoble.com, Barnes & Noble stores. I used to say border stores, but you can't say that anymore.
Yeah.
And they're in bookstores, and they're certainly available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Also, the publishers.
So, are you sort of like me, where you try and cobble together a living from all these different things? You're a teacher at the Tennessee University there. You're also obviously a public speaker. Do you have four walls and a roof where you have a shul?
No. I did, for 20 years, as you mentioned, I had Temple Beth Or in Miami, Florida, 1981 to about 2000. And I did that. I loved that. And then when I turned 50, I was done. I sort of woke up one day and said, great career, what's next? And I moved beyond that and never took a full-time job after that. So, I cobbled together things. I teach religion at Middle Tennessee State University part-time. I run an interfaith center in Nashville, Tennessee part-time. Most of the time I'm writing books, but the way you make money from books is after you've written them, you run around the country talking about them. And that's what I do.
People come to the book signings, and you'll sit and you'll sign, and they'll buy the book. That makes sense. It's good. Your parents must be very happy. They have a son who's not only a rabbi but a writer. I mean, and a PhD. The nachas they must feel every year from you is unbelievable. Do you still have your parents, God willing?
I do.
Oh, mit mazel, mit glick. That's wonderful. But so were they Orthodox?
Yeah, and they weren't overjoyed when I went into the rabbinate. And when I told them I was going to the Reform Rabbinate, they were, my dad's reaction, first he thought a rabbi was a terrible job. He was president of his shul for I don't know how many terms, and his relationship with rabbis was always conflicted. So he says, oh, a rabbi, that's a terrible job for a Jewish boy. And then when I decided to go to the Reform Rabbinate instead of Yeshiva University or something, he just burst out saying, it's a church. How can you go there? It's a church. I had no experience with Reform. I had never been to a Reform temple when I applied to school there. I was actually following a professor, a phenomenal historian of Judaism, a guy who's deceased now, but Ellis Rifkin. And I heard him lecture in Jerusalem, and after a couple of lectures, I went and said, where do you teach? And I said, I'll be there.
Wow.
I worked with him. I was his gopher for 4 years when I finally got to the States. So
he was the ultimate mentor in some ways of what you became and what you ended up putting forward. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, he helped me understand Jewish history, the Jewish mindset, a lot of that. I mean, he was open to all kinds of religious things, but he was, again, from Baltimore and a very Orthodox upbringing in Baltimore, and he didn't have the interest in Buddhism and Hinduism and the rest of it that I did.
Well, Baltimoreans don't. It's just Baltimore. But let me ask Rabbi Rami the question that gets asked of every rabbi, every priest, every Sufi, you name it, any kind of person who posits themselves as a religious leader gets asked the basic question, why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people?
Yeah, well, the same answer I would give the same answer to the question, why do things happen? I don't think it has anything to do with the people themselves or good and bad. I mean, number one, what's good and bad depends on the individual. So right away, that whole notion of good things happening, bad things happening, good people and bad people, all of that is purely from the human perspective. From the divine perspective, I think it's just things happen. And you and I might say shit happens, but not from the absolute. It's like, again, to go back to an ocean.
Boy, you certainly aren't Orthodox. I'm sorry, yes, continue.
No, if you go back to an ocean wave analogy, the ocean is huge, and parts of it are storming and parts of it are calm, but the ocean isn't willing this storm on one group and the calm on another group. It just does what it does because of its own nature. So I don't see God as a volitional character who's going, oh, Rabbi Saul needs a blessing and Rabbi Rami needs a curse, and I'm going to do this for them. I don't see that at all. So things happen. Sometimes things happen that are good. Sometimes things happen that are bad. And we simply have to learn to accept it. For me, just to take it one step further, one of the greatest teachings in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew scripture, is Job. Chapter 2, verse, I think it's verse 9.
Oh, I'm sure it's verse 9. It must be. No, I have no idea.
Must be. If I said it, yeah, it must be verse 9. So in 2:9, Job is devastated. His kids have been killed by God, because of a bet that God made with the devil. I mean, the whole story is to show you that, this whole notion of why God does this and God does that then his response is, shouldn't we accept the good, the bad, as well as the good from God? The idea being, God is the source of everything. Isaiah 45 says, God says, I create light, I create darkness, I create good, I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. So, to me, the God is reality. God manifests reality. Reality always has these opposites, good, bad, up, down, etc. And you and I have to learn how to navigate them, and there is no, why did this happen to me? And I tell you, when people say that, especially when they have an answer, it sometimes drives me nuts. In 1994, I was living in Miami through Hurricane Andrew, and my neighborhood was demolished, much of it. And we walked outside when the storm had finally passed in daylight. And there, right across the street, there are three houses, one untouched, the other two on either side totally smashed. And the woman walks out of the house that's untouched, and she talks to us, and she says, oh, God was watching over me. And I said, but what about your neighbors? What, God has, like, tunnel vision? God only saw your house and didn't see their other house? I mean, when you say that, it's a damning statement about God, and it's a damning statement about your neighbors. So I don't ask that question, why do bad things happen to good people? Things happen.
But then if you take that idea, then the corollary is, well, then you're basically, fate is fate. Stuff happens, good, bad, indifferent. God really is just, it's, God is making it all happen, but he doesn't care, he's just doing whatever he does. So why pray to him? Why not pray to a, you know, an oak tree, or not pray at all? Because it does no good. What's the point?
Yeah, pray. I agree, there's no point. Praying to God to change reality is like praying to the sun saying, stop shining. You know, I mean, the sun doesn't choose to shine, the sun shines. That's what it is to be a sun.
Well, not in Sweden, but everywhere else, yeah.
So to pray to God to say, oh, don't do what you're doing, that makes no sense to me. I think you can pray to God as a, I mean, I'm not that big on prayer. Let me put it that way. I prefer meditation.
You are a rabbi, right? Oh, no, I'm kidding. Yes, okay.
Don't forget. But I'm not that big on prayer. I find that the liturgy, the standard liturgy of Judaism is quite problematic for me because it's very dualistic, it's very masculine. And it reflects a world where, you know, you go to the Sultan and you say, oh, you great Sultan, you did this for me, you did that for me, and you took care of my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents. By the way, I need a horse. I just find that, I think we've outgrown that. And I think you can come together to pray. If the prayers articulate the community's deepest values, I find a value in prayer. It's a way of coming together and saying, you know, we root our sense of justice in the divine. And so we give thanks to God for that. But to pray to God to change reality makes no sense to me.
That's a very, very smart, intellectual answer from Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Rabbi Shapiro, do you have a couple more minutes with us by any chance?
Absolutely, Rabbi Saul. I'm here as long as you can tolerate me.
Oh, my God. I'm here as long as you can tolerate me, which for most people is about 2.5 minutes. But let me ask you, we're coming on an election year. Every time you turn on the TV, you can't miss it. Do you think rabbis and people who are in leadership positions in religion should be political? Should they be out there campaigning for causes, campaigning for particular politicians they believe in, or should they stay out of it completely?
I think we have to be very careful how we do it, but yeah, I think they should be out there. I think religion should be in the street. I think that they should be...
My religion's in the gutter, so you can put it wherever you want.
You do a lot of bowling, so to speak.
Right, there you go.
I think that rabbis... Or whatever, but let's just stick with rabbis. Rabbis should be speaking from the pulpit, saying that this, in my opinion, these are the values of Judaism. And I can't tell you who to vote for, but I can articulate our values, and you should at least take those values into consideration when you walk into the voting booth. I don't think you can go out and say, vote for Gingrich, vote for Ron Paul, vote for, you know, whoever it might be. Now, where I live here in Tennessee, there are pastors who are really challenging the government on this and standing up on Sundays and telling their flock who the actual person to vote for, and they're daring the IRS to come after them. That, I think, is crossing the line. But should they be out and talking about the causes they believe in? Absolutely. I mean, that's how we got the civil rights movement. And the interesting thing, is that religion is all over the map. So you have very liberal evangelical Christians, and you have very conservative evangelical Christians, and we tend to paint them with the same brush.
There's liberal evangelical Christians? I've never come across this.
Yeah, I mean, the magazine that they sort of rally around is called Sojourners. And just because I want to tell you the guy's name, I can't remember. But, I mean, they're not liberal the way I might be liberal on certain issues. I mean, they're not pro-choice, and that's something that I happen to be. But when it comes to social justice issues around the poor and around the homeless and around progressive taxation and things like that, there are many evangelicals who believe that this is exactly what Jesus taught. And then there are many who say, no, Jesus said this is an individual thing. If you want to help the poor, go ahead, you help the poor. The government should stay out of it. So, you know, they like Judaism, it's all over the board on that. But there are absolutely liberal in that sense, social justice-oriented.
Sure. But let me, speaking, since you also brought it up, how much flack, if any, have you received? Maybe once you were out of the Orthodox area, not so much, but being both pro-gay and pro-abortion and a rabbi, I have to feel that you've come across some flack over the years in holding that position.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say pro-abortion. Everyone should have an abortion. But, pro-the woman's right to choose. I don't think that's standard reform. Position, that's a standard Reconstructionist position. I don't think that's very radical. I think the same is true with homosexuality in liberal ends of Judaism. That's not a problem. Yeah, in Orthodoxy and certainly in the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox world, it's very problematic. But not, I don't get flack for that. I thought you were going to ask me about being a Jew in the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Okay, I'll ask you about being in Tennessee. And I was wondering how many Jews there are in Nashville. You know?
In Nashville, there's actually...
Well, they're all agents for the musicians. But other than that, who else?
Well, actually, you get a lot of Jews in the legal end, in the business end of music industry. You get a lot of Jews in the hospitals in Nashville. We have some very fine hospitals and universities. So there are those standard Jewish work environments. But
And then there's some Chinese restaurants, so all the Jews are there, too. But other than that, where?
That's why the Chinese restaurants thrive there.
Yeah.
I think there's 7,000 Jewish households in Nashville, and there's two Reform shuls, a Conservative shul, an Orthodox shul, and two Chabad. So there's a lot going on. Now, I live in a town called Murfreesboro, and we don't even have a minyan. It's very different where I live. I live where the Middle Tennessee State University is. So here it's very, very hard to find a fellow Jew. But what I found is I am a novelty. And a lot of churches will have invite me to come and talk to their members about Judaism. And what I do is I said, I'd like to teach you the religion of Jesus rather than the religion about Jesus. Religion about Jesus, that's Christianity. But the religion of Jesus was Judaism.
True.
So, and I say to them, when the rabbis ask Jesus, what's the most important commandment? Besides Deuteronomy and Leviticus, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and love your neighbor as yourself. He says, that's it. I said, well, that's Judaism. So then from there I go and explain Judaism to them. And they're very receptive because there's a real hunger on the part of many Christians, many devout evangelical Christians, to understand Jesus from the inside out rather than just the outside in, to understand the religion he grew up in and what he was working with.
And his limbic system, which has always puzzled me. But if you're coming across, and I guess this also goes to the political and being on the forefront, if you're coming across evangelicals, and if you're coming across Orthodox and conservadox people in our tradition, do you sometimes feel that it is your responsibility to try and move them to your way of thinking in terms of it's okay to be gay? Or, you know, life does not begin the minute sperm hits the egg. You know, do you stay away from that because you know you're not going to win? Or do you feel it's an obligation to say, you know, people, wake up. You know, gays are 10% of the population. It's not a perversion. It's just who they are.
Yeah, I tend to be the second. I think these issues should be discussed. I tell you, I think, now this is anecdotal, but my experience is that a lot of people just need a little helping hand to shift their position, especially on the gay and lesbian issue.
That depends where that hand is reaching. No, I'm kidding, but continue.
I think that I think in their heart of hearts, many people know that demonizing homosexuals is wrong, and it's wrong on many levels, and they really want to stop doing it, but they live in an environment that just sort of takes that as the norm, and they just need a little help to shift and say, you know what, God doesn't, you know, down here we have to hear people say, God doesn't make mistakes. Well, okay, then being a homosexual isn't a mistake, so now what are you going to do with that? If this is what God has done, because that's how they usually talk about it, then let's recognize that this is part of the divine plan also, and that these people are also, you know, we're talking to Christians, so these people also bear the image of God and are part of the body of Christ. So, you know, that a lot of them are looking for just a way of a little nudge that will get them a little push, that will get them a nudge, not a nudge,
a nudge.
That will get them over the hump.
Well, hump being the operative term in the section.
I knew that you were going to say that.
Of course I was going to say that. We have one or two last questions for the wonderful Rabbi Rami Shapiro. I want to remind everybody again that you can get all his books on Amazon.com. You can go take his course. You also teach creative writing, which is interesting. Is it all spiritual stuff, or whatever people want to write, do you grade as an English kind of teacher in Middle Tennessee University place?
I do two things with that. I have a program called Path and Pen, which is writing as a spiritual process.
Ah.
And I've got a book coming out with my son, who's a professor of writing here at the university. So he and I wrote it together about using writing as a spiritual practice. But I'm the director of the Writer's Loft at Middle Tennessee State University, which is a non-credit, non-degree writing program, and that's, you're right, it's just any kind of writing. We use the English faculty plus a lot of our own faculty and people who are looking to get published, who want to work one-on-one with a mentor. The university provides that, and I direct that program now.
Exciting stuff from Rabbi Rami Shapiro, rabbirami.blogspot.com to read his blogs and his thoughts, which are even more entertaining and interesting and smart than what we have been hearing here on Dave's Gone By with me, Rabbi Saul Solomon. But let me ask, what are the holy rascals?
Oh, okay. Yeah. The holy rascals, first, it's a film project that I've been working on forever with these wonderful filmmakers in Portland, Oregon. But a holy rascal is someone like you, it sounds like. A holy rascal is somebody who is steeped in their faith, but pushes the envelope almost to the breaking point, maybe even the breaking point. So there are these wonderful teachers like my rabbi Zalman Shapter Shalomi, or Matthew Fox, or Andrew Harvey, or Cynthia Bourgeau, all in these different religions, who are, they're not leaving their religion, but they understand it in such a broad way, in such a deeply spiritual way, that they're not afraid of reinventing it for the 21st century. And they often use humor and rascality to do it. And those are the holy rascals.
I like the sound of that. If you have an extra minute and a half of footage in the film, I'm available. Let them know. You know, call my agent, which is basically me.
I'll have your people call my people. That's it.
Well, both our people is God, so there you go. And the last, and really the key, the most important question for me about Judaism that I want to ask Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and if you want to take a moment to think about it, but the question being, herring in cream sauce or herring in wine sauce? Which is better?
Cream sauce.
Cream sauce! This is true. Although wine sauce is nice, but if you're serving it on a Saturday after services, gotta do the cream sauce. You need the heaviness with the bagels.
Absolutely.
Rabbi Rami Shapiro,
about that.
It has been an absolute delight and an intellectual joy talking with you. Do you have any last thoughts to leave with our listeners, something spiritual for this fine Shabbos morning?
something spiritual. Well, you know what? Breathe. That's the most spiritual thing I can think of. Don't forget to breathe. Eat slow. Actually, clear out those lungs.
Right, maybe that was not your best advice. But
every time we breathe, we're in touch with the divine.
Well, it has been Divine Talking with Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Thank you so much, Rabbi. Shalom to you, and much success with more books that you're writing, with your teaching, with all your projects, the film projects. And, I'm glad that the spirituality is in touch with you, and you are in touch with spirituality. It is a beautiful thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Saul. It was a pleasure being on the show. Zygazunt.